experience in astrophysics. This is the work that I do with Martin Wood at University of Western Ontario. So Dickey superradiance is a phenomenon that is very well known in quantum physics community. But for the first time, we have applied this phenomenon to the astrophysics. And here in this talk, I will mainly, I will give a short introduction and show some examples. But because of the lack of the time, it won't be many examples. So from the name superradiance, you would expect a very energetic phenomena. We know other energetic phenomena, like burst events in astrophysics, like masers, lasers. But right at the start, I want to emphasize that superradiance is a fundamentally different phenomena than masers or lasers. For masers, which operate in microwave domain of the light, or lasers, which basically operate in the optical domain of the light, we have an inverted medium, which, unlike a normal medium, where we see that if we have, let's say I have two energy levels, E1 and E2, E1 is a lower energy level, atoms and molecules naturally tend to occupy the lower energy level. But if somehow through some pump mechanism, more atoms and molecules are put in a higher energy level, that's what we call an inverted medium. We have a bunch of atoms, excited atoms and molecules that basically are very unstable, and they are waiting to go down and release their energy. So in maser or laser, the physical mechanism behind this damp part of the energy is a stimulated emission phenomena. So let's say that I can invert the medium through some pump, and eventually some photons are emitted. So these photons act as seed photons, propagate in my medium. And every time that they encounter an excited atom or molecule, they're going to stimulate emission of a photon with a similar phase frequency characteristic, similar polarization. The output is a very bright directional source of light that we call it maser or laser. So the main thing for maser or laser is that they are a series of successive stimulated emission events that are basically producing this light. Superradiance is a totally different phenomena. It has a very different physical mechanism. Imagine that this atoms that are basically kind of inverted, excited atoms that are interacting with light. Imagine that I can assume that the whole inverted medium that I have acts as a single quantum mechanical entangled system. And then calculate the rate that how this entangled system is going to damp out this energy. This is what Robert Dickey did back in 1953. He assumed that my atoms, my excited atoms in the medium, act as a single quantum mechanical system, and calculated the spontaneous emission rate from this from my system. So what he found was that, considering the whole system as a single system, and the entanglement in this system results in enhanced rates and followingly enhanced intensities, what he called superradiance. To lay down the main idea, how basically considering the system as one and entanglement, how it's going to alter the radiation rate, I start from a single simple atom. So, if my atom is is placed in an excited level, the state of the system is up. After some time, spontaneously, this atom is going to basically decay to the ground state, emit a photon. And if I have a detector and I'm watching in my detector, the probability of detecting a photon will decay exponentially over time scale tau spontaneous. Yeah? This is the fundamental time scale for each atom depending on the transition line that I'm looking at. Now imagine that I have two of these atoms. They are both in the excited level, up, up. But they are indistinguishable, meaning that I can say that's the right atom, this is the left atom, and they are acting independently from each other. So what happens to these atoms? We know that they are unstable, they want to go down to the lower level. So after some time, they're going to decay, and I can exactly say if the right atom decayed or if it's the left atom that has decayed. So I can write their state. And after some time, these atoms are going to go down to their lower level. And the time scale that this will happen is, again, tau spontaneous, the time scale that would take for one atom to basically go to the ground state. So having one atom or two atoms did not make a difference. I had one photon overtar spontaneous here. I have two photon overtar spontaneous because they don't know about each other. Now imagine that I can kind of make these atoms know about each other, talk to each other through some kind of mechanism like irradiation. And that will put these two atoms into an entangled state. So now these atoms are not independent from each other. And I can't distinguish between them. I can't say which one is doing what. So after some time, because of the entanglement, after some time, these atoms are going to decay a photon. And when they do, I won't be able to say if it's the left one or if it's the right one. So the state of the system will be a mixture of the two. It's the right one is on the top or left one is on the top. So when I write it down like this and calculate the transition rate from the top up to this level, I'm going to find that the rate is twice bigger, or the time scale for this, the emission of this photon is half of what it would be for a single atom. So what is causing that? If you look at this, if I go from here to here, now there are two channels that are available to me instead of one channel. And that two channel is basically causing this accelerated rate and shortened basically time scale. Now, if I look at my detector, basically I will see that the probability of finding these photons that I'm kind of observing will go down even faster in a shorter time scale. So the main thing, the main phenomena behind this this reduced basically time scale and enhanced rate is the entanglement between these two atoms. Now imagine I have n atoms. Now I would assume that if I can put them somehow in an entangled state, so it's going to basically multiply my emission rate by a factor of n, and the time scale will be n times shorter. So here I'm plotting an example for 100 atoms. So it will take some time basically to entangle these atoms to one another, to know about each other. And that's the time that I call it delay time, tau d. That is related to the number of atoms and the transition line that I'm looking at. And when this system is put in an entangled state, it will basically dump out its energy at once with a very, with an enhanced rate over a time scale, which is n times shorter than one atom. So for my 100 atom, as you can see, the energy basically is dumped out. It's like there's a fast rise that coincides with the buildup of entanglement in my system. And then there's a damp out of the energy, which happens very quickly. The time scale of my burst basically is like n times smaller than what it would be for one single atom. Now, if I compare this, which is what we see for a super radiance with an enhanced rate, to a normal system, non-coherent system, my burst, the maximum of my burst will be 100 times smaller, and the duration of this burst will be 100 times longer. So to summarize this idea, it's like for super radiance, which is basically a characteristic of a coherent system, the time scale of the decay is n times shorter. So if I calculate the intensity for n atoms basically radiating photons of energy delta E over this time scale, I will see that my intensity scales as the square of the number of atoms, unlike a normal non-coherent system where the intensity scales with the number of atoms, like Maser. The other thing about superradiance is that the radiation for superradiance is very isotropic, and I can explain that if somebody has a question. But for now, I just skip it. The requirements of superradiance is we need population inversion. So energy is coming out. It should be supplied from somewhere, and that's from my medium, where I have a bunch of atoms in an excited level. And this requirement is in common with what I need for masers or lasers. The other thing that I need is velocity coherence. So I want my excited atoms to be in good velocity, coherent, so they can basically interact with either seed photon for the case of masers, or with a common radiation field, which is entangling my atoms. But one requirement that superradiant has, which makes it different from masers or lasers, is that the time scale of any other phenomena, like the mechanism that is basically disturbing the state of the system, or basically relaxing the atoms to the ground state through non-coherent channels, if the time scale of all these phenomena should be longer than the time scale of my coherent superradiant effect. Otherwise, what we will have is a non-coherent system. So this this requirement for superradiance, that the time scale of superradiance, TR or tardy, should be smaller than the dephasing or non-coherent relaxation times, implies that there is a critical threshold for the inverted density in the population, in the medium.
You need the arrow going the other way? The time scale should be longer.
No. So you want to wrap up the whole coherent phenomena before anything disturbs you. So other things should happen over time scales that are much longer, and they can disturb you. So you can establish entanglement in your system and damp away your, yeah. Before somebody, so any event would disturb your system, you should wrap up the things and damp away your energy.
Yeah, I'm just confused because you have a T sub R. Is that not the relaxation time scale? What is
so T prime here is the, basically T prime here is any relaxation, non-coherent relaxation.
I'm just confused by the label R.
Sorry, I should have basically, yeah.
R is the radiance.
R is the radiance.
Yeah. TR is the superradiance time scale.
Yeah, what's tau?
And tau d is the delay time, as I showed here.
That entanglement. Thing,
so it times that it takes for coherence to be established.
Right.
And TR is basically like somehow related to the temporal width of the superradiance. But these two should be shorter than T prime, which is what I used to basically show all the, to present, represent all the non-coherent relaxation dephasing.
I think it's just a, it's an accident of language that delay and radiance start with the same letters as dephasing and relaxation.
Yeah.
You are right, and nobody point that out. We will use something else,
that
but in literature they use it. I'm sorry.
It's longer subscripts.
No problem.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know why I should have put probably SR there.
No, it's my mistake.
Yeah. So these are the requirements of superradiance, and this last thing is what makes it different from masers. Now here, I show a couple of examples of application of superradiance model to the astronomical environment. The first thing that I'm showing is the data for methanol 6.7 gigahertz line that is recorded in a maser site, S255 star forming region. The black dots are the data. So maser groups, in the observatory that they were detecting this, they saw this sharp rise in the intensity. They couldn't model it with the maser theory. We looked at the data, and you see this sharp rise and fast decay that we have it. So basically, you can see that over a very short period of time, few days, the intensity is basically becoming 1,000 times bigger than what it was initially. So when we saw this data, we applied the superradiance model. The blue is the superradiance basically model that basically traces the data. Here, what we have is we assume that initially we have some inversion, which is not crazy for a maser region. That is basically this data is recorded. And we show that if there's a pump that basically can pump this inversion, increase this inversion by a factor of 3, it can bring it from what it is, like from the inverted column density that is below critical threshold to the above critical threshold, and I can go from non-coherent regime to a coherent superradiance regime. That's what you see here. If I send the pump and I can basically triple the inverted density in this medium, suddenly coherence can be established in the medium, and the energy is damped away at once. So that's why you can expect a sharp rise followed by this.
So does negative n mean that the number?
Okay, after, so here,
thermal,
yeah. So after what you see here, when you reach basically this point and you exceed the critical column density that is needed for the coherent behavior, you go to the superradiance mode. And when you're in superradiance mode, you quickly damp away the energy. But what happens with the superradiance is that it basically you damp it out and you reach the part that one characteristic of superradiance is that you reach negative densities. That means in this case there are more atoms in the ground state than a higher level. Yeah. But then it doesn't stop there because it's unstable. It's like imagine a pendulum. Like you go to the top and it's very unstable. You come back, so it quickly quenches, reaches the negative value, and there is some reabsorption go up, and this basically, so if it was a longer talk, I could have shown.
So what is the time scale of these oscillations? Is it like tau d, or I'm checking in terms of those time scales you were?
So if you look at this, So I'm talking about days.
No, I'm talking about the parametric that you have this
tau d and
tau v and tr.
Yeah, depends on your system. So I have the data, and basically I see this sharp rise. I fit my model to it, and it gives me some parameters. The main parameter that I get out of this is the inverted column density, and the width of this from my data, it gives me my tr. Yeah, so. As you can see here, my TR here is on the scale of days, and my tau D, which is related to TR, should be on the scale of days. Like usually it's a factor of 10 bigger than TR. For the astronomical data, if I have one pulse, it's hard to talk about delay time because I don't know where is the start exactly. But this width will give you some idea about the TR, and from that TR, you can extract the inverted column density. And depending on the assumption that you do for the density, you can find the length of your TR samples, so that's why it was.
T1 and T2, TR and T.
So these are like these different relaxation kind of effects that are in the medium, and they're working against your superradiance. T1 is the non-coherent relaxation, T2 is dephasing. So one example is like collisions that they happen and they bring down the atom to the lower level. Those go in the category of T1, but there are collisions that they just disturb the phase of the atom. Two atoms, they get close to each other, they perturb the energy level, and they change the frequency. That's like a dephasing. That goes in the category of T2.
And then both much longer than.
And you can see these two.
Your times.
Yeah, yes. Are longer than my TR that I get here. Another example that I have here is for an FRB verse 3 from Michele data for the first repeater that was basically detected. The black is the data and blue is our model. Here we have a slightly different conditions. The first data that I showed was recorded in a Maser site, Maser region. The conditions that we need here are more similar to what we would expect from a mega maser. For example, like AGNs around supermassive black holes, the numbers that I need and the inverted population densities. Here I'm showing a different mode that triggers superradiance. In the previous slide, I showed that if there's a pump that can triple the inversion density in my medium, it can trigger superradiance. Here I'm showing that if you send out a coherent pulse into the medium, you can inject coherence into the system and imprint coherence in like those excited atoms or molecules that you have in your system. That will bring down the critical threshold that you need for the coherent behavior and superradiance. And you were in non-coherent mode, and but after the injection of the coherent pulse, you can go above the critical level, and the coherence will be triggered, and you can have superradiance. So this is what I'm showing here with the for the data using the OH line 6030 megahertz. So there are more examples that I didn't include in these talks, but these are just a few. And the basic idea is that superradiance is an energetic phenomena. You can apply it to bursts of different time scales and get some kind of information about the environment that is kind of causing it. Thank you.
Any questions?
So could I just, maybe I missed it, but so I understood from the beginning that the pulse was electromagnetic wave that was felt by the entirety of the population, right? I mean, it had to be, population had to be localized to much smaller than the
No, world. What I showed because it's just, I have never done this presentation in 10 minutes. So I just wanted to give the basic idea. So one way I said that when the system is in an entangled state, and I said the atoms should be indistinguishable. So if all your atoms are squeezed inside a very small length, which is smaller than lambda, so to your lambda, they're indistinguishable, yeah? But that's an ideal system. It doesn't even exist in the laboratories. But we know superradiance have been observed in many, many experiments, yeah? So in a real experiments in the lab or in real systems, atoms are not squeezed in a short, dimension. They are basically, there are large samples that I took out of this talk. The main thing is that you can establish an entanglement between these atoms. Your system can be like as long as like 1,000 or millions of lambda. Yes. Yeah, it doesn't matter. What matters is that you basically, you can imprint some phase in these atoms, and there's some kind of...
Okay, so coherent. So you need them to be interacting with a coherent, exciting phenomenon. So what is this blue line, I think, is describing this coherent phenomenon? Is this a low-frequency radio wave that's passing through? It can't be. What is this?
Which one? This one?
Yeah.
I forgot. Now, you know, Martin will be upset at me because I forgot the main thing to say here. So this blue line is like I need a coherent signal passing through my medium, for example, for my FRB. We have coherent signals like pulsars. What I'm injecting here is a young pulsar 100 parsec away, and I need 100 Jansky in energy that goes into my medium and it starts, triggers this. Sorry, I should have said that.
So it's a coherent radio beam or something?
Yes.
Okay.
Right. It's a seed with a super radiance. Yes.
So can you tell me why some of these you have these oscillations and then others you don't? I mean, what it determines when you have oscillations?
Okay. So if I have a long system, and it's what usually we have, and then the energy is coming out, and we put the detector here. Yeah. So these are a bunch of atoms in an excited level. Yeah. And then they start damping out their energy. So I'm going to put this shadow for the ones that are basically in an excited level. So initially, everybody is excited. And then they start damping out their energy away. But when they damp out their energy away, what happens is that the light that is here, you detect it, but the light that is basically emitted here propagates. So here I don't have excitation anymore, but the light that was emitted here propagates here. When these atoms, they go down, they can absorb this, reabsorb it, go back to the excited level again. And this time my sample is not this big, it becomes this big. And this continues. Yeah, every time you damp away, the ones that are farther apart, their light, their photons are reabsorbed here, and they are re-emitted. So every time that this happens, you will see another burst. You will see another burst.
So
why is it that some...
This is, the more of these you see...
But then if there are some phenomena here going on, some effects that they are basically, you know, interfering with this,
right,
they won't let this reabsorption, re-emission take place. They basically... this thing will wash out. So it depends on your medium, depends on the kind of condition that you have there. For some of them, you know, maybe the dephasing, it's not like that bad. For some, it could be. So for the large sample, the main thing is like, imagine that you're sitting there. So the light is propagating. It can be reabsorbed, re-emitted multiple times. But as long as it has the chance to basically every time to establish an entangled state and basically damp away its energy, it will continue doing that until some dephasing process will stop it. Yeah?
Great. One more or two more questions.
Okay. Are you calculating this black curve numerically or do you have some analytical...
Which one? This
one?
Black curve, yeah.
So what we are assuming here for the black curve is like some initial inversion in the medium, which is not crazy. For example, for my megamaser, so the numbers that I'm getting is in that scale. So we assume that we have some inversion, and then we send a trigger. There's another mode that I didn't include. You can send a pump that basically increases this. And then as soon as you send this, you will basically have the onset of like this coherent thing. How do we do it? You have the data, and you look at the temporal width. That gives you some idea about your superradiant time scale, yeah? And from there, you can calculate like what kind of densities should be in that system. So look at this. It's some millisecond inverted. That gives you some frequency bandwidth. And I have the frequency of the line, yeah? And then basically I take that delta nu from my data. I have new frequency that I for the line that I basically want to fit to this data from like using the working out the redshift. I find like 6030 will work. And then from here, I will calculate my delta V, yeah? How many inverted atoms, excited atom I have inside this delta V. And then we know what is not crazy for the assumption, like to assume that we have for the inversion density. For example, we know that assuming that I have 0.1 excited atom per centimeter cube per 1 kilometer per second slice is not a crazy thing. So I take that And then I look at velocity slice that is covering my data, and I calculate the density that makes sense there. Insert it there, and then I inject the trigger pulse there. And from what I need here for my trigger pulse that basically is explaining this data is that I need a pulse that has a, like an energy power density of like 100 Jansky. And that could be a pulsar that is 100 parsec away. And we know, I'm not an observational expert, but we talked to Brian Gensler that works on pulsars, and he was telling us basically that there are at least like 8 pulsars with that kind of like a energy density range, even in our own galaxy. So it's not a crazy. You take the data, you work out some numbers, you know that what is sensible for the medium, and then see if you can trace the data.
Okay, I think if you have time, we're going to break for tea.
Well, we can.
That's a very quick question.
Yeah, I think.
Or you can discuss
okay.
It. But yeah, go ahead.
So as I understand, you need this entangled atoms, right? You mean this coherent light. So for this light, do you also expect entanglement between, let's say, the photons within the light?
Oh, photons?
Yeah.
So I need
it's coming out.
Yeah.
Yeah. I need entanglement for the atoms and not the photons. And what you see here that if you have entangled atoms, the light that is coming out, as I said, the photons will come out at once. So there will be bunching effect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The entangled.
Yeah. But the photons are not entangled. They're two. So there are entanglement in the light and there are entanglement in the matter. And they are two different things. It's a lot of work to entangle photons, but it's a different kind of line to entangle atoms. But we can discuss this. So no, I just need entangling between atoms because I'm changing a fundamental characteristic of my atom, which is the transition, basically decay time
he's
scale.
He's not asking if you need it. He's asking if it's the
no,
consequence.
No, it's not. I don't think
he's
so.
He's asking if it is the consequence.
No, I don't think by looking at the photons there, except that they arrive at once, you can say if it's a coherent system or not.
Okay, I think we've done it. So let's thank Freshtey again.